very compact eye for terminator, Lewis eyes and mustard. These are all the different kinds of of testing for the unknowns, testing for presence of unknown gases and so on. And the people who are really chemists came and tested and ran the test on these various gases and so on. And then at the end, that's when I started giving my public lectures to them.
You mentioned that last week. Yeah. You started off in with that. When did this last from? It was
1943 to 1945. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether I should give you this or give it to the Princeton. Probably to the Princeton.
I think probably to the Princeton archives. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's and those are that's exactly the sort of material I was talking about before. That should end up there, because that's it is an important part of the record of Princeton's service, your service to the state in this case, but also Princeton is interested
Princeton's in general service.
Now, in addition, we gave these courses. This is the ESMWT. I couldn't find the records for you. I've been too busy, as a matter of fact. But I will eventually find them, and you can see them. The book's about this big, and is all the different courses we gave. They're all graduate courses we gave to industry, and we gave we had 300 people, all 3,000 people all told. I suppose we probably had about 1,500 people taking two courses during the time.
Was that at the same time you were doing this?
The same time doing this, yeah. And I would go up to Newark, and it was hard work. I'd sit in the phone booth for 8 hours calling all the industry. Well, Henry Irons giving one o'clock. It has. I didn't know that, Doc. Sure, we want. We'll send you three. We had to have, I don't know, it was 20 or 30 in order to get money from Washington for it, you see. And I only had 17. I had to get three more. Well, I always ended up with about 40. Mm-hmm. I just sit at the phone putting money in, calling one after another. And sure, it never came through to us. Sure, we'll send you three tonight. We'll have three there. And then I'd call Esso and Lane, everybody you can think of. I had a long list of them. And they'd all come out, and they would be given a very stiff course. I mean, the professors that were teaching the graduate students here went up and taught up there, you see.
What was the rationale behind that?
The rationale was to upgrade their people so that they do better research.
Mm-hmm. And it was
An engineering science management war training program out of Washington, sent to the engineering department. It had nothing to do with chemistry at all. And Heacock ran the engineering, and he came to Taylor and said, could we do something with chemistry? And so Taylor said, will you manage it? And so I said, I'll manage it. And I don't see how I lasted. I would teach all day long. I catch the 5:37 train. Everett Wallace would start an hour for the train, and I'd start 3 minutes before the train left. And we'd get on the same train, and we'd go up, and we'd get home about midnight, and did this 4 days a week.
In addition to 2 days in training.
Shows you what you can do under pressure.
Yeah, well, we would like to take a look at the scrapbooks if you can find them. Mm-hmm. The only other thing that I wanted to ask you about, or that I had, in addition to anything else you'd like to tell us, is I wonder if you would just reflect a little bit on the changes that chemistry has seen in the last 65 years since you first started off as a chemist at Princeton.
Originally, in the early 20s, there was a sense of analysis. Professors were earning extra money doing analysis. Companies didn't have their own research laboratories, mm-hmm. and they're buying, they're manufacturing special steel or something. They wanted to know how much manganese is in the steel or how much titanium in this new steel. And they didn't have their own research laboratory. And so they'd come to Howell Furman and ask him, can you find out how much is it? Or what should our chemists do? How should we find it? Or what instruments should we use to discover it? And so the chemist acted as a consultant. A great deal, because I only know from 1920 to 1925 when this happened. Then in 25 it changed, and now research on a much higher level. Up until then, there wasn't really what you'd call much research. Mm. Research at a much higher level with Hugh Taylor, spearheading it, and Laura Jones is somewhat an organizer, and now Smythe and Howell Furman beginning to take over responsibilities. The principal ones I would say would be Smythe and Furman and Taylor. Greg Doherty did some work with sulfur chemistry, but not really top-notch like the other people. Creditable. Then came 1930, and then from 30 to 40, the really important people were Taylor and Eyring, and Turkovich working with Taylor at the physical, and Smythe by himself, not working with them, but working by himself in dialectic. And Patshu in sugar chemistry, very fine research man, Patshu in sugar chemistry from Budapest. Mm-hmm. And Everett Wallace, very fine in natural products. Wrote the chapter in Gill, two chapters in Gilman, mm-hmm. on natural products. So they had a very strong physical chemistry and a very strong organic chemistry, and Howell Furman in the analytical. And Earl Cayley, that's right, Earl Cayley had an interesting, but you ought to get a hold of Earl Cayley out of Ohio State. He was chairman of the department of Ohio State for a while. Mm-hmm. Earl Cayley had a year's leave of absence by the American Philosophical Society to set up a laboratory on the Acropolis and analyze all kinds of things. And he was able to show by analyzing coins, and the tin trade fell off up in Wales. They used to ship the tin down there. When it fell off, and they substituted lead for tin. And by analyzing the percentage of lead as a tin drop, he could date something within about 50 years. And then he followed up and proved on the things that Colin Fink had done. As taking Colin Fink was up at Columbia, and he was president of the American Electrochemical Society for 25 years. His son took chemistry with me, His son was definitely not a scientist. But when I think I may have told that when they came around, you know, shut them off. And he was a wonderful guy, but he certainly wasn't a scientist like his father. His father was a top electrician. His father was the one that developed with someone else the chromium plating bumpers, you see. And this is Lane and Fink came from this, the same thing, you see. And Life came down to make a photograph of Life in Princeton, walked into the chem lab library, and Colin Fink happened to be reading probably the only book he'd read that year. And he appeared in Life magazine in the chem lab reading it. His father was just delighted. He just couldn't believe it. And his son just laughed about it. I probably have only been there 5 minutes in the whole year, but they haven't slapped me. And Dad just was so tickled. Well, Colin Fink developed the techniques, which I'm sure you know about, of taking crumpled up mud, curses, for example, or lead. If you hated somebody back in the ancient time, you wrote on a lead sheet, you scratched, this guy ran away with my wife, and then you crumpled it all up and you threw it into a well. The idea of the gods flying over there might pick it up and read it and say, gee, he's pretty bad, we'll punish him, see. Well, over the years it all oxidized and so on. And Colin Fink, and because the electrons, now you pump the electron back in again, and it'll go back again to form metal, you see, in earth. And you take a lump of just mud, and you delicately remove it and put it hanging in a basket, and then reverse the current that had taken 2,000 years for it to corrode to form the carbonate. And it would go back, and out would come a coin with a picture of the emperor in 200 BC on it. And Cayley did a great deal of that for the American Philosophical for a year, and that was the early 30s, before I went to Ohio State.
That's archaeological chemistry is coming.
Oh, that was 1950. Now 1950, then everything changed because Pease is very important. Sure, Pease in that 19. Around 1930, at the same time, along before iron came. Peas, I tell you, a very important role in. So they had some very good chemists actually there.
How did things change after the war?
Well, after the war, Iring had left. Pachu inorganic became very important. Pachu and Turkovich became very important with taking over some of the, you ought to interview Turkovich, mm-hmm. by all means. He has what is that? My father had it 15 years. His mind is just as sharp as can be, but not. What is the disease that they have? Where they can't move.
Parkinson's?
Parkinson's. Yeah. In a very bad stage of it, but his mind is just as sharp as you. Oh, definitely. He can tell you a lot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that was an organic. From then, I didn't thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I was so busy. From 1960 on, I was so busy with this stuff. I had a team of about 10 people working with me all the time. Mm-hmm. I was so busy, and I don't know what was happening the rest of the way.
Yeah. Well, and you were going off at a furious pace. Giving
I was lecturing four times a week. Yeah. So yeah.
One. Let me ask you another. Related.
Oh, I tell you one other thing that might be interesting. Yeah. How Princeton changed from 1920 to 1970.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very interesting. From 1920 to 1927 or 8. It was a country club. When I was here, there was no country. It was a country club. And mm-hmm. I don't know, 70% of them came from prep schools, and high school kids are hardly any of them. They were on the periphery. And it was just a country club where you got a gentleman's B-, or otherwise they frowned at you and so on. Then came the Depression in 1929 to 32. Then I came back to teach.
Mm-hmm.
And those first 2 years, when I first came back, the Depression hadn't quite hit, and it was still a country club. But in about 2 years, by 1933, when a student wrote in the Princetonian, something's got to be done about this. This is the second time this week Dad's written to me asking for money. And suddenly the whole thing fell apart. Now they were no longer a country club. They were serious, and they were working. And from about 1933 to 1940, they were wonderful. And then the war struck. Now suddenly, overnight, you had a bunch of neurotics. Kids that knew that they would probably, as they happened to be, they guessed correctly, 6 weeks later, they're in the trenches.
Mm-hmm.
They made wonderful sergeants, mm-hmm. you see, and they trained them to go out directly into combat. And they knew that it was a matter of a couple of months and they'd be actually fighting.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to listen to you. but they did. But they were neurotics all the time. Well, I only was here for 2 years for that, with the ROTC, you see. And then I went to Washington. I was in Washington all the rest of it for 3 years. Then I came back, and then came the worst bunch I have ever taught in my life. They're completely, all of them were, all these eras were completely different. Suddenly, from 1945 to 1948, I had the worst bunch of people I've ever taught in my life.
Hmm.
All they were interested in was getting good grades so they could get into graduate school or get a good job outside. And they would fight like mad over one point. Hey, Dad, I'm going to come see you on an exam. I got 95. My roommate got 96. And I ought to get another point for question number 3. He has marked wrong. I said, all right. I said, all right, come in and we'll look at the exam. No, I want that. I said, no, I'm sorry. We look at the exam. No one ever came in with a 95 that went away with more than 94. Nevertheless, I said, lower than one. They never came back again. Because it was so easy to find something that was wrong in a paper, you know. In the end, they get about the right thing. But I could find, well, look at that. You know, what that was marked by. But that one's, yeah, you get credit for that. That's one point. But this one is 2 points off for that. They never came back. They were the most disagreeable people. They just fought for a better grade. And then I came home, just in 1950. I said, Evelyn, you can't believe the change that has occurred to the freshman that faced me this morning. They are completely different. They're there. They're in, you can get their eyes. They're interested in everything you said. They're not interested in putting down what he said, but they're interested. It's a completely different world. It was. And they were delightful from 1950 till about 1960. And then the race came on for getting better grades to get in better high schools, to get better college, graduate schools, you see. And from 1960 to 70, they weren't nearly as delightful to teach. They were there. They were there to learn, but they're also there to get grades. The grades became more important than the learning. But from 50 to 60, it was just delightful. They were so anxious. And from 32 to 1940, they were delightful to teach. They were always delightful, but I mean, there were different grades of interest. And so by, and then the girls came in 1970 or thereabouts, 69. You see, and. They didn't make very much difference. I enjoyed having them. They didn't make a great deal of difference in teaching them and so on. But the period of the country club, and then financial distress, and then working hard to 1940, and then 3 years, 2 years and a half, 3 years of wrecks, and then. Horrible people who were interested in what the grades were, and then a delightful decade of people were there to learn. Mm-hmm. And then a decade was delightful. They were there to learn, but they're also there to get grades, and that intruded on. Nowadays, I'm afraid it's intruded on even more, so I don't think it's as much a delight to teach them now, perhaps, as it was back then. Mm-hmm. Although, I don't know, I think Princeton has changed and given way in a way that I think is, I approve of what's happened. Mm-hmm. I think it's very. As far as I'm concerned, I sent my granddaughter here because I liked it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well,
I think Bowen's done a wonderful job.
Yeah, well, it certainly has seen a lot of changes in your years at Princeton.
Yeah, so.
Well, I
didn't tell you about the absent-minded professor.
Oh, that's right. Please do.
What happened there was I was lecturing at the Belgian Fair. Oh, and I haven't done UNESCO chemistry in Far East. That's terribly much. What do you have to go? You have to go now.
Well, I have to be in Philadelphia in a little bit. I have to leave fairly soon. But please tell us those two tales.
Well, what happened was I was lecturing there at the Belgian Fair, and Disney came over to the American Pavilion to see a Sukarama, and they said, "Ah, oh, treat me like a tourist." The king wanted to entertain them. I'm going to take up the National Palace where Professor Allier is lecturing. They didn't know it was in French, but he got there, it was in French. He stayed through three of my lectures. He stayed for 2 hours. In fact, I said to him, privileged today to have the world's greatest educator, and I Mr. Walt Disney. He came and said, "What do you teach, Professor?" And then he sent me a telegram. I have it somewhere, I don't know where, from Hollywood. "When can I call you, Monday or Tuesday? I'm thinking of your lecture in Belgium with Fred McMurray playing your role." And he talked, and I gave him a break and called after 6 o'clock when it was. He talked for over half an hour. He wanted me to come out there. He said, "Remember, it's not a." And then, and I flew out. Oh, there's an awful lot to tell you, but I won't bother to tell you about it. I always fly tourists, but this was a first class plane, and it was full of Miss Rheingold contestants. They're all girls, they all come from Hollywood. They're all professional. They said, you know, in the contest, you know, they pick out the 6 prettiest, and then Rheingold advertised for several months. And if you went and got a drink of beer at Rheingold, you could cast a vote for one of the 6 girls. You see, and here were, I don't know, 100 girls, all very pretty, all. And they said, and the girl that sat next to me was nobody's fool. She had a master's degree in psychology. And she said, "You know, we're all professional models, but we don't say we come from Hollywood, because that would, I was born in Pasadena, so we say Des Moines or wherever we were born, it's where we come from." Mm. And I was no fool. Before we landed, I got a picture to show the boys when I got home. The first thing I did in my lecture that morning is, "Oh, boys, see, I made hay while the sunshine." and when Freddie, when Disney called me, I always end up with something good. When Disney called me, he said, "Now, Doc," he says, "where do you usually," instead of saying, "I'll turn it over to the secretary for the range where he's saying," he spent 15 minutes, 20 minutes. "Now, Doc, where do you usually stay when you're in Hollywood?" I'm going to say, "Joe's Bar." And then I thought quickly. I said, "Oh, Freddie's up at Stanford. He can fly down, and my nephew and his wife are here at Caltech, we can have a family reunion over the weekend. I said, I'll come out Saturday, and I know the people at Caltech. I worked there for a while. I said, I'll get the chemicals and everything there, so your men won't have to go. That's fine, Doc. And where did you stay then? I said, in Huntington. Well, actually, when my niece had come out, I put them up at a little hotel called the Fifield, which was a third-rate, lovely hotel, nicer than the Hilton. It had a lovely courtyard and everything, but it wasn't the number one hotel. So when I landed there, all the girls surrounded me, said their names, hoping I'd tell them, this is Dizzy, oh, you ought to see Gene so-and-so. And when Freddie came in, they gave me the bridal suite. I had two rooms, and plopped up on my bed, I had this Hollywood guy. And she gave me, she wanted to take any picture you wanted. Well, I took the one that had the least clothes on. and she wrote on it to Professor Allier from Ann Newman. She was on the six, as a matter of fact, later. And I had it propped up in my bedroom, and Freddie comes walking in, and now his mother's back in Princeton, and here's his dad in Hollywood. Take a look, he says, gee, Dad, you're a fast worker. So he called up Mother right away and said, I'm being chaperoned by Freddie, it's all right. And, well, anyway, Monday morning I start to go over to this. I met at the airport by a guy in a Rolls Royce and a cap and everything, and a handwritten two-page letter from Walt Disney apologizing he couldn't meet me personally because he was opening up Disneyland that afternoon. I actually saw him on television doing it, and that's somewhere in my file somewhere. But the chauffeur would take care of me. Well, I didn't want the chauffeur. I was going to ask. So I said to him, I said, look, I can drive the car. Wouldn't you like the weekend? Thank you, sir. Thank you. Oh, he went like that. Probably to spend the weekend with his mistress and tell his wife he was spending it with Professor Allier. So anyway, so Monday morning I drive over to the studio. Now, right in the center is where our office where about 30 workers are. And then that's surrounded by acres and acres of land where all the actors are. And maybe 5 miles further on is the first gate. And I get to the first gate. And the policeman, can't come in here. I said, well, I got an appointment. I said, what's your name? Professor Allier. Oh, Professor Camellia Gray. Then I got, and finally, there's another gate right before all the bigwigs are. Another gate. The policeman, can't come in here. I got an appointment. I said, what's your name? Professor Allier. Oh, Professor, come in. Then I go in. And here's a parking lot. Oh, there are only about 20 places. Parking lot. And place number one, a painted wooden sign, Mr. Disney. Place number two, a painted wooden sign, Professor Allier. So apparently every day they paid a new name. And I spent from 9 that morning till 5 that afternoon with Walt Disney. Just the two of us. Mm-hmm. It was just the most fascinating. He was just so nice and good and interesting. We talked about a series of teaching and his series of teaching. And he said, you know, Doc, this is not a scientific movie or anything. It's for fun. But there's one thing they'll learn about. One is that professor discovered flubber. Was the only one in town that really was doing things exciting. Moreover, he was not a absent-minded professor. He was a single-minded professor. Mm. And that's true. When you watch it, you go away not laughing at this absent-minded professor, but thinking, gee, he was on the ball, wasn't he, you see? And then, after noon came time, in the contract I said they couldn't mention my name or Princeton. I was going to have absent-minded Professor Hubert Eisbrecht. The man that directed, his name was on it, took me for lunch. He'd take the doc away and bring him back for lunch in 20 minutes. And he gave me this huge office of 10 times the size of a desk, 4 times that big. He said, now these are your quarters this week. I was there for a week. I said, give me a call. No, doc, we want you to feel at home. And then he took me in the journey room. It was a big library and 3 pretty secretaries. And then his room was beyond it. He said, you have anything in this room you want? I said, I'll take her. He said, oh, Doc, you've been around. And then we went to lunch. And as we went down to lunch, there were 3 steps down. And here were 28 people, 7 tables of 4 each, of these bigwigs that had been doing Disney the World and toys and all morning long. And as I walked down with Disney, it was in front. You get to know the thoughts of the people you talk to, you know. And I'd give a couple of $100 to have a moving picture of the faces as those 28 people turned and looked at me, 24 people looked at me. Who the hell is that stranger? He doesn't even belong to the club. All morning we tried to get to first base, and that guy's at home plate. There was no question. That's exactly what's going through their mind. Sat down, we're up on two of the 24 jumped up and rushed over. Hello, Professor Addy. He taught me chemistry, Mr. Disney. Yeah. Wasn't that comical? Anyway, so I had a wonderful time there. Yeah. Gave the lecture, and Fred McMurray and June Haver came and watched me, and Fred McMurray came up there and said, you know, Doc, I had a lot of participation. Mm-hmm. June Haver was very quick. She came up with the answers. And he said, Doc, that's the first chemistry lecture I ever understood. I took it in college. Well, he took it in Carroll College. And I lectured at Carroll to 1,200 high school kids at a science fair. And the head of the department took me around to see me the new laboratory. At the very end, he said, Doc, the most interesting thing I'm going to tell you, we held out until right now. Do you know who our most illustrious alumnus is? I said, no. He said, Fred McMurray. I said, do you know what he said about your chemistry teaching? But it was a fascinating experience that I had for this. Now, the other thing is the chemistry in the Far East. I'll talk fast.
Oh,
okay,
you don't have to talk fast.
No, in 1963, I guess it was, I got an invitation to go to UNESCO to meet in Moscow with Art Campbell for chem study, Len Strong with the chemical bond, myself, two people from Nuffield, one from Australia, and two from behind the Iron Curtain. But one was from Moscow and the other was from Czechoslovakia. But they wouldn't let them meet in Paris for fear the two might defect. Hmm. So we have to have the meeting in Moscow. And for a week, or maybe 8 days, 10 days, we met in Moscow. And what we discussed was to set up a laboratory for high school teachers in the Far East to bring the Far East countries up to date on what chemistry was being taught. And Mayberry, maybe you know Mayberry, was chairman of the... He was at UNESCO. Hmm. Was it Dick Mayberry? I'm not sure. There are two of Bob Mayberry, I'm not sure, Bob, I guess. There are two of them, one's a brother. And he was chairman of it. He was with UNESCO in Paris. And for a whole week and a half, we discussed how we thought chemistry. He wanted my tops for the people to know, and he wanted the chem studies, the Nuffield people to. And for 10 days, we discussed it. Then he went around and found where would they locate this school. And he finally picked out Bangkok. And Chula Longhorn, this is by 1964, the first one's given. Chula Longhorn University, they gave us one of their laboratories about, 10 times the size of this room. And they invited from 9 different countries, 2 teachers from each of 9 different countries, from Japan, from Indonesia, from Malaysia, from Sri Lanka, from, they came from Israel later, but I don't think the first one, from India. Anyway, there were 9 pairs of people came for a whole year. Mm. And there we taught them. And every time I went through 13 times, I'd always have to stop for a week and teach them about my tops, you see. And every year they'd bring a new bunch in. And for a whole year they would work, and they would write a laboratory manual and a textbook of what they had learned about what chemistry was being taught all over the world. And when they got back to Sri Lanka, for example, they usually... from the teachers' colleges, 2 teachers from the teachers' colleges. When they got back, the government was pledged to UNESCO to set up a traveling van where they would take all the chemicals with them and equipment and would travel around from one little town to the next where chemistry was taught in their country. For 2 years, they would be given an ample salary, these 2 people, to teach it. And the last time I went through there was probably 1973 or 1975, about 10 years ago. That one room in Chula Longhorn University had grown to 2-story brick houses with 150 people in it. The Thai government was so impressed with its value that they set up their own. Hmm. Isn't that an interesting thing?
Yeah, well, your influence has really spread far and wide, hasn't it, from through all those efforts. Let me turn the tape over.